research the agents. Go to a bookstore, go to a cafe bookstore, take down 10 books from the shelves that are like your book in subject or area or style or sensibility. Look in the acknowledgments page, see which agents are mentioned. Go Google those agents. Get familiar. Somebody who has done their research, and they say to me, you represent this author and that author and this author. I think my work is like theirs. The more it looks like you know that you're writing to me, because your book actually might speak to me. And then one page, and if it has a little personality, great. If it has a paragraph that effectively describes the book and makes it sound fabulous, great. It hooks me in already. If there's a little humor, unless it's, you know, like a sad book or something, that's great. A bio that shows your assets in a nutshell, that's great. Short, sweet, a little personality. Do not have typos.
You're listening to episode 61 of 88 Cups of Tea with Yin Chang.
Am I doing this right? Hi, I'm your host, Yin Chang, and thanks for joining me on 88 Cups of Tea. This podcast is created to leave you feeling motivated from interviews with storytellers, where we learn how they create opportunities for a successful career without losing sight of the values that make us human. Whew, that was a really long run-on sentence.
Hey, what's up, Storyteller Tribe? Before we get into today's interview, I wanted to thank Gotham Writers for sponsoring today's episode. They teach creative writing classes in New York City and online and have built an incredible writing community. Be sure to hang around at the end of the show to find out why Gotham has earned an amazing reputation within the writer's world. I am so excited to have Gail Hockman on the show with us today. You guys are in for a really special treat. Gail is the president of Brandt & Hockman Literary Agents and the president of the Association of Authors Representatives. Gail has built an incredible legacy of representing quality writers like National Book Award-winning author Julia Glass, Pulitzer Prize-winning author Michael Cunningham, Scott Turow, the author of Presumed Innocent, and Pulitzer Prize and Academy Award-winning Jules Feiffer. In today's episode, Gail and I discuss her role as a president of Brandt & Hockman, and we unpack how the AAR is an incredible organization for literary agents and a powerful resource for writers. Storyteller Tribe, if you're curious about how a literary agent can help to cultivate a writer's career, or how to write strong query letters, and how to create genuine relationships with mentors, you're going to love this episode. Now let's get right to it. Gail, how are you?
I'm good. It's a beautiful day in New York. We're a little bit out of the hot spell. We're about to go into fall, so I'm a happy girl.
I'm so excited to have you on the show, and I know a lot of listeners are super pumped. Gail, I'd love to kickstart and ask, how did you get into being a literary agent? It's a fully loaded question.
It's a good thing I speak quickly. I was in college, and I thought I would be a doctor, so I did all the pre-med courses, and I majored in neuroanatomy and neurophysiology. I spent some time in Italy, so I added an Italian as an independent sort of a minor, and I thought I would go to medical school because I wanted to work with emotionally disturbed children and their families as a doc, but I hated the lab courses, hated, and I thought, not a good career for me. Going to medical school wouldn't be the right choice. I sat back thinking, what on earth am I going to do? What kind of job? I have no skills. What do I know? So a family friend was a publishing guy, and his house was always full of manuscripts and books. And I was always a big reader. So I thought, fabulous. That's the world for me. So it turns out I talked to that person who became my mentor, who was a big publishing executive. I got my first job in a publishing house, which is now part of the enormous conglomerate Random Penguin Viking. But at that time, it was an independent house. I worked there for 2 years. And then I thought the company had just been bought by a corporation. I thought, this may not be the job for me forever. The kids were not going to be promoted. You work as an apprentice and you get promoted, little half steps. We all realized time to get out. So I happened to get a job working for a literary agent and stayed with it. And here I am.
You did mention that originally you wanted to do medical because you want to help emotionally disturbed children. Why specifically emotionally disturbed children? Is it something that you resonated with?
In summers, I did various social works and worked in summer camps for children with various issues. They were emotionally disabled or intellectually disabled. It was so easy to give, and the families were so grateful. I felt a connection to that kind of work. Actually, I did not find a career that far from that kind of work, if you think about it.
I always make a joke. If I make friends with talent managers or agents, I'm like, you know, you're kind of like a part-time psychiatrist, psychologist, and therapist at the same time.
Well, you're definitely a part-time psychiatrist as an agent, like an advisor. I find that nobody really listens to what we say. They don't do what we suggest, but it allows them to think through options. And that's one of the things that we have to do in our job.
Did you feel like you learned that through just your experiences?
Publishing is totally an apprenticeship business. There are schools that have masters in publishing. And so in those programs, you do some work teaching you how this thing works and how that thing works. And you learn the range. But basically, you do learn on the job. And you learn by watching folks around you and above you. I think you learn by watching other people, how they do it. And you don't say, I will do it that way. Usually you say, interesting, they solved that problem. They dealt with that situation that way. I would have done it a different way. And then when it's your turn, you do it in the way that seems right between you and the other person and their real issue. You learn by experience. At this point, I have four or five younger people in my office and I'm the boss. They come in and they say, do you have a minute? It's never a minute. And they say, so-and-so situation. And we talk through options. I think you learn over time based on what works in a particular situation. There's no one answer for many of these things. For some reason, I have a knack to rephrase the question or put a different spin on the problem. And that helps us find a better solution than if you were sort of stuck.
I was reading this New York Times article that focused on you and about externships. And I read that you have two children, a son and a daughter. Being a mom, does that also help you communicate with your clients?
I suppose, but people who don't have kids also can be, you know, wonderful at this. I think you have to be open-minded, open-hearted. You have to listen to the other guy before you start making decisions or giving advice. If you ask my kids, am I successful as a mom helping them solve their problems? One would say yes and one would say no. Neither of them has interest in this business, though, alas. My son at one point said, Mom, I don't want to take AP physics. I don't want to learn how to help rich people get richer. He's very democratic and intellectual. My son is doing a PhD now in philosophy. He was a debater as a high schooler. It taught him how to think, taught him how to write, taught him how to be logical. So that's about it. His philosophy library is about as close as it would come to my world of books. And my daughter actually always has a sophisticated book in her hands. But she works in nonprofit in the arts, in the visual arts.
Oh, I love that. Oh, congratulations. You must be so proud.
So two children who are not on a money, on a stairway to money. So they come home for dinner whenever they can. Let's put it that way.
But you know what? They're out there doing their thing, doing heart-centered things, you know, and I think that's admirable. Gail, if you don't mind, if I could touch back on that article in New York Times that was published in 2010 about externships. And it's funny because we were talking about how you segued into being a literary agent and you yourself had a mentor. What was your experience like in that externship?
I believe that if you're a young person taking a job in publishing, people would say just get your foot in the door, which is true. But I think you're going to learn more from someone who's quite a bit older than you because they have larger experience. Somebody much closer to you in age, if you're a young publishing professional, is going to be nervous that you want their job. Mm-hmm. I think the wisdom of earlier times is very valuable to add to your repertoire. But it's an apprenticeship business. I think you really, as a young person, either looking for a job or trying to build a career, having started in this field in the first place, a young person, I think, really needs to find one or more mentors who really care about you and will advise you. I have people who now are like hugely ranked in publishing houses who used to call me to say, can I talk to you off the record? Can I call you at home? And they would want to talk through their career things. In many, many colleges, there is some sort of program where the students are required or it is suggested that they look for it. Internships, intern meaning you just work in the office. That school was my daughter's school, which was Carleton, wanted to give the kids the full experience, living with the professional, going to work with them. I think that idea is overrated. I think you need time away from somebody. I think staying in their house makes much of a difference. So let's just talk about the idea of internships. Internships meaning you work in somebody's office. Most of the high level, let's say agents, don't have time to sit around and talk for hours with the interns. But you want to go to a place that gives you a certain variety of work tasks that shows you what the range of what that job is. You're not going to be able to negotiate contracts. You're not going to be able to make decisions on which clients we take on. But you can look at contracts, let's say compare the current to the old contract. You could read manuscripts, write your report, and then I think it's useful to discuss with the agent, let's say you're working for an agency, or the editor if you can, if you're working in a publishing house, discuss what they thought about the book, what you thought about the book. They'll ask you questions. The way you read a manuscript or a book or a publishing job is very different than the way you might read that same manuscript for an English class or even a creative writing class. I think the internship, to watch how they do it, what's the tempo in the office, How do they operate? Do you feel like it's a good place for you? Is very, very, very useful in a young career. Now, I have a friend who is a very excellent agent who died prematurely. She was in her 70s. What we found interesting was that my office operates on a multitasking style. Everybody is doing 5 things at once. We do 90 things in an hour. These two women had come from a quieter or slower office. So they sat in their office and they watched us running back and forth like a cartoon when the woodpecker's head turns left and right, left and right, left and right, yeah, to watch a tennis match, because we just do 100 things in an hour. The other agent was very successful and very beloved and very admired. So there's different tempos and different kind of offices. That's another thing you might learn if you were an intern.
I know you said it's super important to find mentors. How would you go about advising one, find a mentor?
If I talk to people my age, we won't discuss my age, but if I were to talk to people my age, what we really dislike the most in any younger generation is the idea of entitlement. If somebody hounds you and says, be my mentor, we're all going to say, excuse me, it's time for me to go out to get a coffee now. Let's just show a couple of roads to a mentorship. I went to Oberlin College. Oberlin has a January term. In January, the students are supposed to find a work opportunity or a work study thing or a travel, or they should study a subject and write a paper or work for a professor, something like that. I have taken Oberlin interns here for, let's say, 15, 20 years. Many years ago, I took an intern who happened to be the niece of a publishing friend of mine. I liked her so much that I hired her when she graduated from Oberlin. She worked for me a couple of years, and then she came in and I knew she was going to quit and I was heartbroken. She said, I just want to tell you, I love you. I love working here, but I want to really be an editor. I don't want to be an agent. And I think it's time I should start looking for an editorial job. That was 10 years ago. That gal is so high on my list of priorities. From being an intern, I cared about her, and then I hired her as a staff person. And then if she were to have a job offer, she will always call me. And I know that she's graduated not being a junior person needing so much mentor when she doesn't call me. She calls me to tell me she took the job. If I have an employee who I love, who moves on to something else and I stay in touch, that's an easy way to be a mentor. You don't say, can I be mentored by you? We have some interns, I have to say, who are childlike and don't seem to get with the program. We have other interns who are fascinated. They look left and they volunteer to do work. They look right. They volunteer to do work. They learn as much as they can. They hand in fabulous work. And I tell these people, please keep in touch. And when I hear of a job offer that could be great, I will send it to them. Those people, if they were to keep in touch, would have an instant mentor in me. I wouldn't be calling them once a week, but that's a kind of mentorship. It also happens, and this is bizarre to say, I cannot go to a wedding or a bar mitzvah or anything and wait online for the ladies' room or at the bar or anything without somebody coming along. Well, what do you do? Oh, my nephew either has a novel or my nephew needs a job. It's very, very funny. So personal relationships that are meaningful to me might lead to a mentorship between me and that person who is the niece or the nephew or the next door neighbor's child of this other person that's my friend or my favorite relative or something like that. You need to be known to the person who you want to be your mentor, and they need to know you in a positive light. And asking them advice once or twice will set up informally the fact that you care about what they say. And if you act intelligent and that you're listening and you're not just entitled in some way, that person will be very proud to follow your career. I just realized from my end, from people my age and my experience, the half an hour that I give to any young person who I might be trying to help is worth hours and hours and hours to them. So it's a half an hour out of my life, which can be busy, but it's worth so much to them that it's worth it to me to do. It's paying forward, kind of. I'm going to be a rabbi in my next life, just so you know.
How many do you think, just off the top of your head, mentees do you have?
Nothing's official. An intern who worked here 3 or 4 years ago may call me and say, I'm seriously considering so-and-so job. What do you think? I may not remember exactly who that was. My colleagues and the younger kids in the office will remember who it was. And so then we'll try to piece it back. But if they value my opinion, I will talk to them. There are many times an employer will call me and say, so-and-so person worked for you. That's not exactly a mentorship, but I would have to give a recommendation. You can't say how many. I have to say that I have 4 young people in my office now, and I completely adore these people. I don't know if that's official because they're my employees, but I think they know for as long as they want, I'm here for them. So that's a kind of mentorship. I think at any time you have 5 or 8 people whose lives you really, really care about.
You have all these people coming to you and you still have time for them. And on top of that, you're the president of the Association of Authors Representatives. Like, what?
I know. Don't ask. I don't know. I say to people that I have a 28-hour clock back ordered, that one day it'll get here. Years ago, somebody said to me, who was asking me to do something totally out of my field, and I was pregnant and I was working. I thought, why on earth would you have the nerve to ask me to do this huge thing? She wanted me to help organize a huge thing. And she said, well, when you need something done, ask a busy person. Frankly, I resent that. I resented it then and I resent it now. I think that number one, you have a job, you have to pay your bills. Number two, publishing is a job most of us do because we love what we do. You know, you have bad days and you have bad manuscripts and clients who misbehave, but you basically do it because you care. Number three, I hope that all of us can put back in the world in some way. I think that's important. I was on the board of the Agents Association and I watched the people who were the president. And then I thought, I can do this. I decided so I would run that job. Our organization has a board of directors and 8 or 10 committees that do wonderful work in various areas, studying royalty accounts and royalty statements, studying contracts, a membership committee, digital affairs committee, international rights details committee. Somehow one of my skills is to get people to do what they don't want to do. In the AAR, my committees have become much stronger since I'm the president. I don't know why. They say they work for me because I inspire them. I don't know. But they do what they didn't think they'd want to do. And people are dying to get on these committees. So there's not, you know, what do I have to do? I manage this whole organization. But everybody does an outstanding job. And I think we're moving forward in such an outstanding way. You know, you try to be inspiring to other people. You know, and then you go home and you close the door and you say, oh, I don't have to talk to anybody for a while. But I do believe in giving to the universe. I think it's essential. If you have enough money and you have enough time, I think it's your obligation to in some way do something positive out in the world. And I find that people ask me a lot and I say yes a lot, which that's the crazy part. Okay.
Okay, for those writers who are listening in who may not be aware about the Association of Authors Representatives, the AAR, could you give them a snapshot of it?
Okay, AAR is the one professional organization of literary agents and dramatic agents, even though now it's much, much, much more predominantly literary agents. It is book aid in North America. So our members must adhere. It's like a guild. You have to be accepted. You have to have certain qualifications. You have to have sold a certain number of books in a certain period of time. You have to say that literary agent work is your primary work. You know, you're not a school teacher and you do this on the weekends. We all have to adhere to a canon of ethics, which is a lineup of promises that we make. And it's basically promises of honorable behavior. If a writer is looking for an agent, it is very useful for you to know that they are an AAR member. If you're a writer and you're looking for agents and you've written letters to a bunch of agents and some people say, yes, they love your manuscript and they want to represent you, you do have to ask those agents a number of questions. You might find it useful to know if they are an AAR member or not. And you can go on our website, which explains what the organization is and it gives a canon of ethics and you'll see what that all means. Now, there are so many wonderful agents who are not members. I'm not saying that not being a member says something, does not say something, but being a member does say a lot about that agent.
Let's say there's a literary agent or someone who interning and wanting to rise in the ranks as a literary agent, what would the benefits be for them to be a part of your association?
An intern isn't going to be eligible to be a member until they have a job. The two categories would be a full member, which is an agent who has sold this many books in this much time, and they don't have to be the owner of a company. They can be an agent in a company. There's also an associate member, I guess, who is an assistant in an agency. So your boss would nominate you. Mm-hmm. The benefits would be this. If you have a question about a contract or if you have worry, like I got an email the other day from an agent who said, I don't know any of these publishers in so-and-so distant country. Do you or does anybody in the AAR know these publishers? So I immediately wrote to the international committee and said, can you help advise this agent? I'm not supposed to advise you on contracts. It doesn't work that way. But you might say, I'm having trouble with so-and-so publisher's contract. And I'll send it to the contracts committee. And they might say, yes, we will analyze that contract and we'll be in touch with that publisher. So in that way, you have a place to call for your needs, even though there's not always an easy answer. But the other thing we do that I think is outstanding, and this has really been grown in an amazing way in these past 8 or 9 years that I've been the president, we have evening programs except in the summer. That is once a month. We will have an hour and a half program. We'll bring publisher and most of their notable editors to introduce, we'll call it Meet the Publisher, HarperCollins or whatever publisher. We have programs on how do you make sense of this new world of self-publishing? How do you help your clients? And we'll have a number of self-publishing organizations represented up there. We might have a program on how do you advise your clients on social media or setting up a website. Informational things. 5 or 10 years ago, I set up a second thing, which popped in my mind one day. why don't we do programs in the daytime from, let's say, 12:15 till 2 o'clock or 2:30? And those are instructional. Like, what do you need to know about permission forms? Now, that is so boring. So it's not an exciting, sexy program. Every time one of us hires somebody, we got to teach them that stuff. So we have a lot of how-to programs during the workday at lunchtime. So we try to do that once a month. And then we started extending all those programs. So we have a program in the summer. We do part A and part B, meet some young editors. So we'll have a panel of young editors who've basically just been promoted from assistant or from associate to full editor. And for those programs, the young agents might come, but a lot of the senior agents might come because they've never met some of these young editors. I do a great program, which is the most fun for me, for agency interns. And that's a program where invariably we have like 20 people sitting on the floor because we run out of chairs. For that program, I get some senior publishing people, sometimes younger people who will be inspiring to these kids because they're closer in age. And they discuss the trajectory of their own career. You see, the AA, it's like this full service place which studies things, recommends things. We cannot negotiate with a publisher on behalf of the organization. And we can never tell any agency how they must run their office. But there's a lot of enriching things we do for agents. Now, agencies that are big corporations like ICM and William Morris have their own internal training things. For them, what we do is not that essential. But for many small agents, we have 350 to 450 literary agent members. That's a lot.
This whole time, I'm just like, dang, how does she manage to juggle all of this? That's my whole thought throughout this whole thing. I'm like, you are superwoman.
If you were here, I'm not superwoman. If you were here, you would see piles of paper. You never throw anything out because one day you might need it. Oh, and then the president of some company is coming into your office and you think, oh my God, I got to throw this stuff out. So you go through everything and you realize, yes, I'm 12 drafts ahead on this manuscript. I can throw this one out, where I had written all my notes for that first draft. I don't want to throw it out until I don't need it. I have lists up and down the wazoo, and then I end up stapling five lists together. You do the best you can do. But all of us, everybody in publishing, and I find this amazing, all of us have a few things that we know we're going to get to one day or that you procrastinate on. Sadly, we do have those things. This is another interesting thing about agents. Good to know for professionals in publishing and for writers. Some agents have a client body of, let's say, 30 clients, 40 clients. I don't think it's easier for them than somebody who has many more. But they have a focused list. They're not taking on a lot of clients. They have time to do what really needs to be done for those clients. And they're probably going to be choosing clients or keeping clients who make money for them. They will end up making more money and having more free time. Other agents like my agency, I tend to have at any time, say 100, 120 people think that I'm their agent. And I am their agent. But they're not active at the same time. I don't have to call up once a week to these people I haven't had a book from in 15 years because there's nothing much to talk about. I'm not going to ask them how's the weather or how's their dog because it's not an issue for me right now. So I have a certain number of books that are active at any time. I have a certain number of books in the publishing pipeline. That is, they're going to be published within the next 12 months. I have a certain number of books where they're not going to be published for much longer time or they're not finished yet. What you need to do for each of those different categories of clients is different. It is juggling, and we never call them enough. And I always leave my desk. If you saw it, you'd be howling with laughter or you'd have my office condemned. I suspect the latter. But you always leave your office with a couple of things. You think, oh, I wish I could have done that before I left, but I have to be somewhere. But all paces of work are fine. In a publishing house, you got to produce enough good books that make money and that make some sort of notoriety in a positive way, or you're going to lose your job. And the same in an agency. But the difference, I suppose, this simply, if you're a publishing professional, if you work in a publishing house, you produce the book and you hold the book in your hand and you try to sell copies of that book. That is your job. If you're an agent, you're trying to develop the writer's career. You do it book by book. You try to sell magazine articles. You try to sell their book. If you have retained these rights in foreign territories, you try to sell their book to Hollywood. Hollywood, that is feature films, is quite a diminished market for most of our books, except for the biggest names. And even then, it's hard to sell. Television has become very prominent for us to sell our books to a dramatic medium. So we try to sell them, let's say, television and sometimes film. So our job is to sell but expand the career of the writer. And the publishing house's job is to edit the book to its best, to design a cover, to get the copy written for the flap copy, for the promotion copy, and to sell that item on the marketplace. You see, it's a different thing. We are the closest to the authors in that we work for them and we only earn money in commissions by what we sell for them. And a publishing house, the whole company earns its money. Every category has its salary, I guess. And the more important you are for various reasons, that's how you negotiate your salary. When I started, people would talk about being on opposite sides of the desk and agents being so scary and publishers and agents fighting all the time. And I suppose sometimes that's the way it is. But I think the reason that I have a lot of friends in this business is that I'm very decent. And yes, of course I fight on behalf of my client. But I don't say in an angry way, give me this, do this, do this. I'm going to say to an editor, this is my way and others could do it differently. I'm going to say, you know, I got to talk to you. We got a problem with author Jane Smith. I don't know why, right or wrong, Jane is saying this and demanding that and upset about this. I know you've done so and so. I know you can't afford to do blah, blah else. How are we going to solve this problem? Or right or wrong, this person is demanding this. I'm not sure how I feel about it. I know exactly how I feel about it. But I'm going to say, I'm not sure how I feel about it. How can we solve it? I have brought like outstandingly intense questions that way. And I usually walk away with an answer that's really good for my client because I was reasonable every step of the way. The interesting thing is one would think, oh, major publishing person, that person has power, the editor-in-chief, the publisher, oh, I'm in awe. Senior agent who's been around 1,000 years with some important clients, oh my God, power is the least of my issues. Power has nothing to do with my life.
That makes sense. Just from our conversations, you're very passionate about your clients and championing for them. What happens with that author who has had no ideas and nothing's able to come out? Are they able to come to you and discuss a new topic or idea that they can try and dive into to then develop a book?
It may or may not be possible to revive a career, and they may or may not really even really want to write, because if you want to be a writer, you just got to sit there and write. We always tell people you should keep your day job. Do not put all the stress of earning money for your rent and your food and your kids' education on your writing, because it's a fickle market. Some people only have one or two books in them. Some people come to us and they pull a book out of the closet from 30 years ago and you think, oh my God, oh brother. Well, once in a blue moon, that book is really good and the time has now come for it. Usually it's not. I own this agency. It's a 110-year-old agency. And I came to work. It was a family firm. So I came to work for the second generation in that family. So I would be the third generation, even though I'm not in their family. So I have clients from 50 years ago that nobody has heard from. Every so often will write us a note, or the widow of a client will send us a manuscript. If it's terrible, you're kind about it. How much time can you give to that? And if it's somebody who is still a vital person with something to say, has the writing ability and has the focus to write a really excellent book and they have good material, then we'll help them like we would help any client. And if it turns out that an old client has now turned to science fiction and we know nothing about science fiction, we're going to say, you know, John, I'm terribly, terribly sorry, but your agent is long gone, your long ago agent, and we don't know anything about science fiction. And it's my old client and they're writing in the field that I know about. I'm going to tell them exactly what I would tell any new client. If the book is good, if it's bad, if I can send it or not. I guess some people talk about reviving a career. I think that if I took on the burden of thinking that I owed it to revive every career, everybody who had ever been an agent, a client of this agency, that burden is too much. I think it evolves. When someone needs our help, we help. When they don't, we don't. Sometimes we haven't heard from them in 20 years and they go to someone else. Fine. Reviving a career happens when somebody specifically says, I took these 20 years off to do so-and-so other thing. I want to come back. Then we'll be all ears for them.
Now, what about those who are very proactive in their writing careers? I read another article about Leah Lax, and it mentioned that you were pushing and pushing and fighting for her, and her book was actually receiving awards along the way, but publishing houses refused to publish the book.
It's not that publishing houses refuse to publish. Agents submit books to publishing houses. We submit to an editor. You submit to editors you think will be receptive to that book. They're always going to say, yes, I want to pursue it here, which doesn't mean they can buy it. It means there's a whole program there. They need to get other editors to say, yes, I like it. They need to get the sub-rights person to believe it's worth money to the company. They have to get the bosses persuaded. Corporate publishing has their own clear sense of what they think they can sell. I worked on that book through, I cannot tell you how many drafts. It's amazing material, very emotional and worthy material. And I don't think anybody thought it was anything but. It's very worthy material. But if they did not want to publish it because they did not think their expertise would lead them to success with that book, they're going to pass. And at a certain point, an agent cannot send a book out to 900 million thousand places because you only get paid by what you sell. And when we lose steam on a project, or you don't think there's anybody else you know how to who to go to, or you get to the point where you have to find the tiniest houses the world has ever seen, then you say, I'm so sorry, see what you can do on your own. And then you feel in a way vindicated because, yes, it was good material if it sees positive response out there. At the same time, you're a bit pissed because you say, I worked so valiantly on that. Why did nobody buy it when I submitted it? Each client has a different story. So it's no use to generalize from anybody's story. So I'm just trying to give you the general state of affairs. We all have books we just can't sell. And some of them you just don't want to give up on. I wake up in the night and I say, oh God, I got these five books. These writers are dependent on me to find more places. I have one very beloved client who said, well, we haven't sold it. Just keep the book out there. And I looked at my list. It was like 40 people I had sent it to. And where am I going to find more houses? Just keep it out there. Just keep working on a book where we have not seen a glimmer of somebody saying, yes, yes, I'm pretty interested. And then the boss didn't want to buy it. It was a book which somehow, I think it was an amazing story and she's an amazing writer. But maybe there was too much there, who knows what. Just keep it out there. And there's a point when every agent has to make the sad decision. Have I done what I think I can do for that writer?
So once you've done everything in your power that you could, then you just have to let it go and just put it to rest and not really, I guess it's like goodbye to that project, huh?
Do you see how hard it is for you to even ask the question?
I know, I feel the pain.
Really hard. I know. It's not true that you've done everything because there's always 20 more tiny presses. You could possibly go to every imprint and a publisher, but you're not going to send it to an editor who's now going to have to spend his weekend reading it when it's not going to be bought by that publishing house. You know it's not going to be bought because that editor has no, or that company has no particular interest, or the boss never showed interest, or everybody else just like that editor or that company said no. There's always something you can do, but you don't do what you know will result in nothing. If I send manuscripts to editors just to keep it off my desk, just to put it on their desk, if I am not thinking this guy might potentially like this book, or love this book, or buy this book, why would I start putting my submissions into the hands of people who are going to think of me as that gal who just sends all this junk my way? Because to those editors, it's junk. So there's never a moment when you've done all you can do. The point is you have to do soul searching and say, when do I think I've done as much as a professional should be expected to do in this position? How much more do I want to do? How much good can I do to this writer if I keep activating? And some agents, when they can't sell it in 20 submissions, they say goodbye. Sometimes they will break up with the writer because they don't want to be associated with that book anymore. We find the writing is kind of on the wall as much as we hate to see it for certain books, that the mainstream houses are not getting this book. And it just takes one. So we are all motivated to keep at it. But you cannot keep at it forever. How can I keep sending these books, keeping these books out there, when nothing is selling for those books and nobody's even liking them at all, when I have all this other work I have to do? So you finally one day have to say, as much as I hate this, I've got to put this aside.
Yeah.
It's heartbreak. And some agents say, I'm sorry, I can't do this for anymore, goodbye, or I'm putting this book aside. Some agents will say more softly, I really think we've done what we can do. If I have lunch or run into somebody or think of somebody, I'll send it out again. I find a soft way to do it. Or sometimes you don't keep sending it and the author gets the point. It's heartbreaking. I don't even want to go there. Let's find another subject.
I totally understand. Thank you, Gail, for even diving into that. I also want my listeners to understand the heart that literary agents put in their work and how much they do try and really champion for them.
Sometimes I will send a book and the editor will say, oh, my assistant read it and loved it and I read it and we really like it, but I'm afraid it's a little small. And once in a while, I'll call them and I'll say, you know what? Your assistant loved it and you loved it and it's a little small. If you really love it, does that really have to be the deciding factor? Because publishing houses will always reject saying this is small. And I have gotten people to reverse their decision. My foreign rights gal, and this is what I understand happens with all the foreign rights departments also in publishing houses. The publisher may be selling your foreign rights if that is how your deal with that American publisher worked out. Or your agent may be selling your foreign rights if you negotiated with the publisher that you'd keep your foreign rights. So two parties might be selling your foreign rights, one or the other. There's various visits of editors to New York and they come to our offices. There's international book fairs. There's Bologna Book Fair. There's a London for Children's London Book Fair. There's a German Book Fair. There's book fairs in other countries. Sometimes you keep on hitting an editor with a book you really like for that editor. And this is just in the history of time, it's always been done this way. You get a rejection from that company in Germany. But sometimes you got a film deal, you tell that company. You got a huge bestseller status in the US, you tell that company, because you really like that company for that book. And over time, you might persuade them, or your agent in that country might persuade them. This is a funny thing. There are so many things that a writer does not know that the agent is doing for that writer. All the writer sees is the rejection letters, and they see the success, you know, the contract. You know, they see their reviews. They see whether we can sell it in Hollywood or TV. They see that stuff. They don't see me sitting at home with a pen spending hours on their manuscript if I want to help edit out the problem that 10 editors have seen. And they don't see the deal that I got out of somebody who had was saying, no, I don't think so, and I got a deal. They don't see the extra little bonus that somehow I got for that book in a contract negotiation that nobody would have thought of, but I got it for them. When I accomplished something that the writer wouldn't, they would just take it for granted. Oh, that's what you got. Thank you very much. But it was like pulling teeth. It was extraordinary effort. It was an extraordinary result. I know this doesn't sound crazy. I have a crown from a costume that my daughter used once years ago in school that I wear around the office with streamers hanging down and flowers, which is insane.
And my I love you.
My office knows that I just did something amazing, whatever it was. I kind of bluffed a negotiation and I got much more money than they seemed to want to pay, something like that. Now, my daughter years ago had to dress up. It was like a science fair. It was like a book fair science fair. You had to dress up as a character in a book you had read. And the parents would come and go from kid to kid and say, who are you? It could have been a biography. It could be a character in any novel the kid read. So my daughter, we had just seen a show about Janis Joplin, and it was a book it was based on, so I got her the book. So that was her character. She was dressed up as Janis Joplin. So I wear my Janis Joplin crown. I know this is insane, but that's what I wear when I've done some invisible success that was bigger than what it looks like when you explain it to the client. I know.
That's great. Freaking awesome, Gail. You're so cool. Seriously. I adore you. I'm just imagining you in your office just walking around with
like
your
a total
crown.
Idiot.
Like a total badass. That's what it is. What's your advice on query letters? What would attract you and catch your attention?
Number one, research the agents. Go to a bookstore. Go to a cafe bookstore. Take down 10 books from the shelves that are like your book in subject or area or style or sensibility. Look in the acknowledgments page. See which agents are mentioned. Go Google those agents. Get familiar. Somebody who has done their research and they say to me, you represent this author and that author and this author. I think my work is like theirs. I'm not so often asking to read manuscripts from queers because I'm over the top. I have 4 young people in my office, and so I usually pass on to them. But the more it looks like you know that you're writing to me because your book actually might speak to me, and then one page, and if it has a little personality, great. If it has a paragraph that effectively describes the book and makes it sound fabulous, great. It hooks me in already. If there's a little humor, unless it's, you know, like a sad book or something, that's great. A bio that shows your assets in a nutshell, that's great. Short, sweet, a little personality. Do not have typos. Do not tell me you're going to cast the movie and this actor will play the role of you in your memoir. So research first, and concise and well-written and a little personality.
Okay, done and done. Very helpful. What are some writing workshops you've been invited to that you really like that you could speak from your own perspective and be like, okay, I recommend this one?
You're invited a lot to a lot of things, and I just can't go. It is exhausting, and I'm not looking to take on clients. The workshop that I go every year because I'm invested in them and I love them is the Sewanee workshop. It's a 2-week program, and Sewanee is an amazing college, the University of the South, beautiful place, friendly. I think the staff is outstanding. So that's my personal, my commitment is to that place. I find the kindness and the dedication of all of the teachers. Each workshop has a senior teacher and a not senior, let's say junior, but the junior teachers are like stars in their own right. So that's what I would say, Sewanee.
And you're also known to represent a lot of award-winning writers. Do you notice a pattern where a lot of them have mentioned that they've gone to a certain writing retreat?
I mean, I suppose one could say there are certain places that many of them have gone. They've gotten to McDowell. There are certain places that these people converge. But this is the words to leave you on. A positive note for writers, and I guess this is the rainbow at the end of the rainstorm for publishing people. We are all inundated with reading. but you never know where your next either bestseller or award winner or favorite book is going to come from. So it used to be we opened up a box with manuscripts. So now we open up an e-file. You open up that file and you start reading. And yes, you love it when there's credentials, when they have an MFA, when they went to so-and-so conference, when so-and-so writer recommends them. But you start reading, and it can be from anywhere that you're hooked in. So the writer needs to send in his best work and just allow yourself to become immersed in the work and not worry about the pedigree of the author and what workshop they went to. However it is that they will refine their skills, if it's through an MFA, if it's through a weekend retreat, if it's from a two-month retreat or a two-week writer's conference, you're not worth more to me if you've come from some great famous writer's conference if I start reading and I just don't get involved. Mm-hmm. But the point is we all open up that box, open up that file with major optimism. Maybe this will be the one, you know, the one now that I can bring to some great success with this book. Or sometimes the next book by a beloved client of yours who never quite broke out. Somehow we summon the energy and we have this optimism. And so however you can refine your skill as a writer, wherever it comes from, if you have a best friend who's your writing buddy, that's fine too.
Got it. Gail, you've been amazing. And we always love wrapping up the show with one last note on any books that changed your life.
I can't say contemporary because the book that changed my life and made me a reader was Little Women, an abridged version of Little Women 100 years ago that I bought in those days, they would have a bookmobile. It was like a little book fair that drove around. I don't remember if it, I guess it came to the school. Is that hilarious?
That's so cool.
I like the cover. It was a laminated cover. And in those days, parents didn't spend a whole lot of money on books for their kids. So that was my favorite. And then as I got older, I loved the Victorians like the Bronte sisters and Thomas Hardy. So when I went for my first publishing interview, like a total moron, I wasn't studying English. And English classes don't read, now they do, but at that time they didn't read contemporary stuff. So they said, well, what do you read? That publishing house was publishing The Godfather Book 2. And I said, well, I love Thomas Hardy. What can I say? I got a job anyway, despite that stupid answer. Now, what I work on now, I have mostly adult, but I do represent a number of kids' books. The series called Magic Treehouse is very exciting to me because it's become 25 years old next year by a writer named Mary Pope Osborne, who I've represented for, let's say, 26 years or 28 years. That is a little series that will make every parent see my kid has just learned the value of reading. Why is reading so exciting? Because it's a whole story that a little kid, a second grader, first, second, third grader, can read on his own. And he recognizes, oh my God, reading is fun. So that sort of thing turns me on too.
Thank you, Gail. You're so awesome.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
That wraps up our interview with Gail Hockman. I seriously loved Gail's straightforward and thoughtful responses. Gail, thank you so much again for your time and for being so cool. Listeners, I hope the episode was super informative and inspiring for you. Thank you for joining us again this week. For the books and resources Gail mentioned in today's episode, head over to 88cupsoftea.com/podcast/Gail Hockman. I've heard from quite a few of you asking about writing communities and classes. If you're working on your own fiction, whether it's a short story or a novel, or even in such genres as mystery, romance, science fiction, and fantasy, I really want you to listen to why Gotham could really help you out as a writer. They started in my favorite city of all time, New York City, my home where a lot of my dreams came true. Just like me, Gotham believes that everyone has a story to tell and they exist just so they can help writers like you tell your story better. You learn from teachers who are accomplished writers and are amazing at teaching. Through lectures, writing exercises, and workshopping, Gotham will also show you how to shift from reading stories to creating them. Gotham teaches all the elements of craft to strengthen your techniques and skills. Gotham even has an acclaimed book on craft called Writing Fiction. On top of making progress on your work, Gotham will also introduce you to the ways of the business. They've put a lot of heart and soul into creating a safe and structured environment for writers to learn for over 20 years. Be sure to head over to 88cupsoftea.com/Gotham Writers to check out their classes. They have a super supportive staff that will help you find the course that's perfect for you. Hey guys, it's me again. Thanks so much for listening in on 88 Cups of Tea. Go create something magical today, and I'll catch you in the next episode. Bye!